From the Middle is proud to be a founding member of the Odd Pods Media Network. Hey, Middlers, welcome to episode number 121 of From the Middle. Way back in episode 110 of our podcast, I told you all a story about a flying man that I observed from my backyard. Well, I'm excited to introduce him to you. J.P. Vitulo is a powered paraglider, athlete slash enthusiast slash hobbyist, and he's going to talk all about what it's like to fly. Play that intro music, Kendall.
Oh, for the love.
Sorry, just clearing my Mountain Dew hole.
I got my phone hole cleaned today.
That's where you keep it?
You're so cerebral, and you're so developed and evolved.
From the Middle after dark over here.
So, back in July, and I think you guys will remember, I told this story in episode 110 of our podcast. Sherry and the kids and I are out on the back patio enjoying a nice summer evening dinner, and we hear this really loud motor sound. And I'm like, what in the heck is going on? So I go out to the back edge of my property and I look up in the sky and I see a man sitting in a chair flying underneath a wing. And up until this point in time, my only experience with any light aircraft like that was ultralight that one of my relatives had built and flew around his property every once in a while. So I'm like, that's one of the weirdest things I've ever seen, and it looks awesome. So I think it's maybe the next week, I see this guy again, but this time I go to the Facebook group for the neighborhood that I'm a part of, and somebody had posted, what's with the guy hanging from a shower curtain with a box fan strapped to his back? And somebody else comments, oh, that guy works at the auto parts store across the street. And I got all excited because I had already told this story. And now I was going to be able to figure out who this guy was. He is with us tonight. I'm so excited. JP Vitulo is joining us, their paramotor guy, or the flying man.
The flying man. Yes, that's awesome. So
we put in our thumbnail, JP, the paramotor guy, and you had a story that apparently someone else had referred to you by the flying man, or was looking for the flying man.
I think it's just kind of the nature of the area that I work in and the area that you live, I guess. And it's also the area that I fly. It's just kind of a small technique community, and I will catch a flight before work or after work or whenever, you know, is convenient. And I guess the residents have gotten to recognize me, and I think different groups of people have assigned a different name for me. I had someone come up to me in the store, you know, and he was actually talking to one of my coworkers about me, and my coworker came to me later and said, you know, this guy came up to me and said, you work with the flying man? And apparently, you know, whatever group he was from, they refer to me as the flying man. And, you know, when they see me flying through the sky on, you know, the weekends, they're just like, oh, hey, it's the flying guy, you know? And it makes me chuckle because I don't give much thought to, you know, I guess what other people on the ground say. You think about it, you know, hey, you know, they must think that's pretty cool, or man, I must be annoying the crap out of him. To think that people, you know, have come up with a name for me and stuff, it's just makes me chuckle.
There are definitely worse nicknames to have.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it is hard to hide when with that hobby. And you're right, like people in town, they just kind of they know that there's a guy that flies around in the air. They don't know who he is. Some people do. But if you say like the guy who flies around in that thing, sometimes everybody's like, oh yeah, yeah.
Everybody knows. Yeah. Yeah.
So like today, even I was telling somebody that we were interviewing a paramotorist, and she's from the town, and And she's like, is it the guy who flies around here? I'm like, yeah, it is. She's like, oh, you know, I've seen him up there sometimes when it seems really cold. I'm wondering how cold it gets up there. So we can make that the first question. It doesn't get warm. Yeah,
it does not get warm. No, it's pretty much gets progressively colder. It's I forget what the formula is, but for every 1,000 feet you go up, you lose like 10 degrees or something. And
so how high do you go up?
Oh gosh, I mean, it all depends. I personally, okay, the law says you can't exceed 18,000 feet, which is pretty freaking high. You start to run out of oxygen at like 14,000. You could do it without oxygen, but you would start to have, you'd get lightheaded and start to be in the beginning stages of hypoxia. So I've been to around 13,000 feet.
Wow.
And I was dressed to the hilt. I had long johns on, you know, snowboarding pants, heated gloves, goggles, balaclava on. You cannot have exposed skin at that altitude. You'll get frostbite like that. And mind you, it was in summertime when I did that too. Jeez. And it was just unbelievably cold. And the other thing is it takes a while to get to that altitude. The climb rate that we have isn't, you know, it's a tablecloth, you know, that we're under.
Yeah,
so
we're
lucky to get up in the air sometimes. And I am not a small man, if you will. So my climb rate is even less though than, you know, some of the other guys that are in the sport. But still, you know, it's an amazing thing that we're able to get out of these machines. You know, it's just a small two-stroke lawnmower engine, basically. And, you know, a paraglider. And yeah. So what was the question? How do we go? Yes.
That's good.
You know, but most of the time, yeah, no, we don't go over 10,000 feet really, unless you're, you know, trying to catch a jet stream or something over some serious ground. They say if you're trying anything, any sort of like acro moves or anything like that, you know, trying to do the barrel rolls or any, you know, anything dangerous, you don't want to do it below 3,000 feet. The higher you are, the safer you are in that aspect, because it gives you more time to recover. Because every foot you are over 1,000 feet, if you fall from 1,000 feet, you're done. So why not be even further up to give you more time to recover? And if you don't recover, I you know, I carry a backup parachute just in case, which I'm sure that's like one of the number one questions I get is, do you have a backup? And yes, I do. I very rarely fly without it. However, I have, and some people don't use one at all. It's all, you know, a preference. It's kind of like, right. It's kind of like driving without a seatbelt on, I guess. Some people, it's just, it goes back to the thing, if you don't fly over 1,000 feet, you know, you can get in a situation where if you did throw the reserve, it could put you in more danger than if you didn't. So there is that argument where if it came loose by accident, or if, you know, you panicked and threw it when you didn't need to, you could mm-hmm. potentially put yourself in, you know, a more dangerous situation than you were. So, It does have its ups and downs. However, I think the seesaw highly leans in the favor of having one for that. Just
to it kind of sounds like the old timers like saying, well, if I get in a wreck and I'm underwater and I'm trapped in my seat with this seatbelt, then who can my family sue?
Right.
It sounds like that argument. It's like, we can play the odds if you want. Like,
yeah.
If you put your, put your modesty aside for a moment, on a scale of beginner at doing this to expert, where would you fall roughly? Where would you fall on this scale? Oh,
okay. Well, I've been flying for about 3 years, I guess. So, in my head, it's important for me to still refer to myself as a newbie and as a beginner, because I think the biggest danger in our sport is thinking you're an expert and not being, or thinking, you know, you're invincible, or thinking, you know, this isn't going to happen to me, because at the end of the day, what we do is potentially very dangerous. And if you get to the point when you're not checking your gear or not, you know, flying in conditions that aren't, you know, appropriate, you can find yourself in a bad place. With that being said, I would say I have more hours than the majority of the people I fly with. So it just, man, that's a really tough question to answer, because it all depends on who you're comparing yourself to.
But I like that perspective though, right? I mean, it's way closer to the ground. I just got a motorcycle and I've been riding for a few years, and you never want to get too comfortable or think that you're above any lesson or learning. And so I think always approaching it with a beginner's mind is probably healthy, because you don't want to get too comfortable or too cocky or too sure of yourself when you're doing something that requires a lot of thinking. And so I really like that perspective.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's important for me. I think it's important. I think it's a good mindset to take. I think it's much better than, you know, some of the other guys that I see that go out there and think that they can't learn anything and think that they're above, you know, one of the big problems we have in the sport is injuries pertaining to just starting the engine, which you wouldn't think that's where you would get hurt. But, you know, at the end of the day, we've got this giant spinning wheel of death, you know, strapped to our back. And sometimes it's hard to get the motor started. So a lot of guys will take it off their back, set it next to them, pull start it, the engine goes wide open, and then there's no stopping it after that. And how the engine goes from, you know, idle to wide open, it inevitably happens from time to time.
Yeah. But
there's so many people that say that that'll never happen to me. I've been doing this long enough. I know how to control it. No, I'm not going to put myself. And then at the end of the day, every month there's a post on Facebook of it happened to me. You know, I don't know how it happened, but it happened to me. And then in that post, there will be more guys saying, I don't care that it happened to you. I've been starting my engine this way for 10 years and it's never going to happen to me. And it drives me crazy, you know, to see that mindset. Why not just pick safety? It's, you know, it's mildly inconvenient, but to do it, you know, the right way is not that much harder.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dylan.
I was just going to say, it feels like the most car accidents happen on the way to the grocery store kind of thing, right? Like, you know, we're so comfortable that we're not paying as much attention or being as alert as we should. Go ahead, Kendall.
You kind of opened a little door there a couple of times and saying of the guys that you paramotor with that you've clocked more hours. And then now I'm mentioning like these guys telling each other like that this happened to me and others. Give us a little insight, because I'm always interested by the communities that pop up around everything. And so like there's a paramotoring community and you all know each other. What's that like? Like, is it mostly supportive? Is it like jockeying for a position? Is there like camaraderie versus competition?
If you're ever bored and you're on the Facebook, I would hop over to the Paramotor Facebook group, because it is the most entertaining group I've ever been a part of. It's just the wide array of different kinds of people that are is just it's very interesting, and it's very mind-boggling to see the different perspectives that, you know, different pilots have. And it's just there's something new and there's something different every day. And I would say for the most part, face to face, the community is very encouraging and very helpful. If we have fly-ins from time to time where, you know, you go to an airport to, you know, a grass runway where you'll get, you know, 100, 200 pilots camping out and just, you know, enjoying a weekend or a week of, you know, just enjoying each other's company, comparing wings, comparing engines, you know, sharing gear and stuff like that. And inevitably you'll have failures and stuff will go wrong. And there's always someone there willing to, you know, lend you their tools or lend their expertise or, you know, help out in some way or another. And face to face, I think people are generally pretty good, but online, I don't know what it is about being behind the screen and a keyboard, but people can be the biggest jerks, if you will, when they've got this buffer between, and they have no problem, you know, telling you exactly what they think of you and of your gear and of your morale. And just, it's crazy. I think you tend to see more of that online than you would ever see in person. So, but in general, I think it's a very, very tight knit, you know, supportive community.
That's so interesting. So like online, they're kind of like what a lot of people might, it sounds like what a lot of people might expect, like adrenaline sport kind of people, like just, you have a bunch of dudes like injecting themselves with Monster and telling each other to crush it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then you meet them in person and they're just like, oh
yeah, just, yeah, nice guys.
Well, let's go back a little bit in time. How in the world, I mean, we never really got your version of an intro, so please feel free to tell us as much or as little as about yourself as you would like, but then how did you find yourself into this sport? Like, what did you see or what? And then I have so many follow-up questions after that.
I guess if I had to put my finger on one thing, I've always been into RC stuff, like remote control. Growing up when I was smaller, I was into RC cars, and that developed into RC planes. And then, you know, that developed into an appreciation for aviation. And I've always, you know, really loved aviation. But never, for most people, it's not a realistic goal to, as a, you know, a job or a hobby. It's because it's expensive. It's crazy expensive to, you know, to get a plane, to have a hangar, to have, you know, maintenance fees and costs and everything like that. I fulfilled my aviation, you know, love with model planes, and then eventually quads and drones when that became, you know, more of a thing. And then you got the FPV, where you can, you know, see what the aircraft sees, and then it just fueled that passion even more so. And then eventually you stumble on YouTube, and then I always watched a channel called Flight Test, and they had a little feature of paramotors on that flight test. And I remember seeing that years back and just thinking, man, that's the way to do it, because I never really saw myself as a skydiver or anything, because of the, you know, you have to rent a plane, you sign up for a plane, you can't do it when you want, you know. And but just the aspect of having my own aircraft and then being able to fold it up and put it in the back of my car and go and fly potentially, you know, whenever I wanted, that was just the dream for me, basically. You know, it wasn't, you know, $100,000 worth of aircraft, and then, you know, having to get a hangar space, and then having to fill out a flight log and a flight plan, and, you know, all that stuff. This is, you know, an unregulated aircraft, a way for me to run into the sky, fly at thousands of feet in the air, you know, with the birds, and just live the dream. When I discovered that was a realistic, you know, something that I could actually do, I started putting money away. And, you know, it took some time and it didn't happen overnight, but that sat in the back of my mind for a long time. And, you know, I guess I was just watching more and more videos, and eventually I saw, you know, another one. I had some money stuck aside. I got on the internet the next day and started looking up schools, and I called Predator Paramotor, which is near Dayton in Ohio. And the guy was just awesome. He was as enthusiastic as you would think, you know, excited to to teach, and you know, let's get you up in the air, man. You know, and it was just.
Did he crack a monster and tell you to crush it?
Yeah, let's do it, dude. Let's, you know, and
let's go.
Freaking send it, you know. When can you get here? When can we get you up in the air? And it was just like from then on, it was like that was my goal in life was to get up in the air, and that was, you know, about 3 years ago now, and it's just been the healthiest obsession I've ever had.
That progression makes so much sense, like starting with RC.
I just love it.
And then, you know, recognizing the restrictions of like, you know, traditional flight or planes or whatever. And then you're like, I'm just going to RC myself.
Exactly. It's like an FPV without the V.
Okay. A kind of related question I've got to ask. Have you ever been into the, like the flight simulator, like the newest version of that is like, I've seen some people doing it on these computer rigs that it's like crazy. Did you ever get into that?
I would love to do that. If I, you know, once again, if I had the resources, that would be an amazing thing to do, because it's gotten, the technology has just gotten so realistic, you know, over the last few years. And it's just, man, technology is great. It's made everything possible. You know, all this cool stuff we're doing, you know, the flying that I'm doing now wasn't, I mean, it was possible 10 years ago, but it wasn't as accessible. It wasn't as safe. It wasn't as cheap. You know, the growth of the sport makes it, you know, the accessibility so much better. And yeah, it's just awesome.
Tell me about the school, because I'm so interested how you go from no experience of personal flight. I mean, you're flying small, you know, RC planes and drones and stuff, so you can get yaw and pitch and stuff like that. But like to put yourself in a seat with a fan strapped to your back under a wing, how in the world and how long does it take to go from I know nothing to I'm relatively comfortable doing short flights by myself or under supervision?
Well, I think the RC actually played a really big role in the physics of everything. I think that there's twofold whammy of that. It's like the understanding the physics of ailerons, pitch and roll, you know, Bernoulli, the principle of what provides lift and how energy is stored. I think that sets you up, you know, for success when you can understand the physics behind that. And then not only understanding the physics, but having the coordination that you develop with, you know, remote control stuff of turning that into your hands and then being able to flip it 180 when you're kiting, you're doing it everything backwards. And that's when we bring the wing up before launch. And being able to have that coordination that I, you know, I feel like I developed early in life with remote controls, and then pairing the coordination with the understanding of the physics behind, you know, flying an actual aircraft, I think it only sets you up for success.
So how long was that class that you took?
That class was, he made me work for it. I will give him that. You know, he's not just there to just send you on your way and get you up in the air. It was probably a month that I actually spent in the class. It all depends on the weather. If you were to go to like Florida or someplace like that, you would spend a week, 10 days, and then be done. But that's because they're able to string, you know, good days back to back to back. But what we do is so dependent on the weather. The wind plays a big role. You can't have, you know, too much wind. Really, when you're starting out, the less wind, the better. But a little bit of wind really does help, because it makes things so much easier. It helps you with lift. As long as it's a consistent wind, you know, listen to me talking about wind. you come to appreciate little things like that, just like the you know, the way the wind is, and it's just, becomes a little more of a spiritual thing. But, I would say I spent 4 or 5 days just with the wing before I ever touched an engine. And that was just, you know, getting to learn the wing, learn the controls, the, you know, different carabiners, the clips, you know, the trimmers, the tabs, the harness. I spent days on that before I even touched a motor. And then after that, I spent a day doing everything I did before, but with an engine on your back, which that's probably the worst time before learning to fly, because it's heavy, it's hot. It was the middle of summer, and having this 70 to 80 pound engine on your back while trying to, you know, cut, you know, play with a big kite in very little wind because it won't stay up or whatever. It's a frustrating time. If you can get through that and learn, you know, what you need to, it just goes, it's downhill from there. It's so much easier, and it really did pay off. So I would say by the time, you know, got enough good days together, it was probably, I probably had my first flight maybe 2 weeks after, you know, the first lesson or whatever. And then I would say he sent me with my, you know, seal of approval, you know, to fly on my own maybe 6 weeks later on. Wow. And the type of guy Chris is, like, I'm still not graduated from his class. If I ever had an issue or something or wanted to go back and train with him some more, you know, it would still be part of the package. He considers everyone a student for life. And I think that's really important, because you see so many people train with instructors and they'll do a week or whatever and then get sent on their way, and then something will come up and they'll not be able to fly for a year or months. And they'll lose that confidence, and their gear will sit in their garage or sit in their basement, and they'll never fly again because, you know, they're afraid or whatever. They just get out of that sort of mindset of being able to fly. And I think that's super important, of having a school that you can go back to and, you know, further education.
Well, I think this is a great opportunity to share, and maybe you can do some voiceover with this if you want, a little 60-second clip, because for those who are still listening and have no idea what this assembly or this combination of the wing and the motor and the harness all looks like, I'm just going to go ahead and share that and check it out.
So yeah, this is a forward launch here. You lay the wing out behind you, you get kind of a couple steps head start, and you just kind of chuck it. You throttle up as the wing comes up and run into the wind, and eventually the weight comes off your shoulders. You know, most of the time you aren't turning this close to the ground. This is, you know, stuff that I learned after many, many hours of experience, but I mean, this is what it looks like after, you know, you've had some, yeah, most people aren't doing that either.
Dude.
I like how you wrote "don't crash" on the one part.
The landings, I feel like, are one of the best parts, because just swooping in like that, your feet are just, you know, just clipping the grass coming in, and then you just, it's hard not to smile when you come in and just nail an awesome landing. It's one of the best feelings. Nothing beats an awesome flight, you know, where everything goes right. You can't beat it. I wish I could share it with the world. You know, it's, but the truth of it is, it is a big investment, both with time and money. And you know, most people aren't going to be able to experience it. And that's why I love to take my cameras up with me and film as much as I can and share it with the world, because the views that we see up there, you know, most people aren't going to see, unless whether it be from a drone or something. But just having that shot where, you know, your feet are just dangling, you know, thousands of feet over the city. Yeah. It's just, you can't beat it. It's unbeatable.
I don't think you can get any closer to like flying. I mean, for a second, I entertained the idea of researching the wingsuit thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I saw how many regular skydiving flights are required to one wingsuit flight.
Yeah, and I was like 1,000 or something.
It's like, it's insane. And I'm like, there's no way that I'm going to be able to invest the time and dollars into that many regular skydiving flights to be allowed to even try the wingsuit. And then you're just kind of free falling with some gliding. Like I don't think there's anything closer to like the dream of human flight than what you're doing. And absolutely. I think it's the coolest, man. And your videos, I mean, I know before we were, before you agreed to come on, we were talking about like other hobbies and interests. And there's this like whole secondary interest you now have in the photography and the videography and putting it all to music. And your social media profiles are just a great browse because you're just getting really good at like really good quality photography, putting it to music. Like something cool happens when the beat drops and
it's
really cool what you're doing, man. So
that's the best part is when you can get the beat to, you know, sync up with something cool that happens.
Yeah.
And when you can get it just right, it really is like something magical. So
awesome.
But it takes practice and computers are hard. You know, I'm no spring chicken. It's like, I used to be really good with this stuff, but it's like, my level of, knowledge has not progressed with the rate, you know, that computers are getting better at, you know, so it's just tough.
But I think this is a good spot to take a quick break and hear a word from one of our friends in the Odd Pods Media Network, and we'll be right back with JP Vitullo.
I'm Rob.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Joe.
I love it.
I think it's kind of meh.
And I've never seen it.
We're Keeping Up with the Cardassians,
a podcast covering 7 seasons of Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
But that's not it. We go down the wormhole
of pop culture, life, and Garrick.
New episodes every Monday
on your favorite podcasting platforms. You can also interact with the show on Twitter at CardassiansPod.
And just like the Ferengi, we can't wait to stroke your lobes.
And we're back with JP Vitullo, the paramotor guy or the flying man, depending on which person in my town you are. So... After I saw JP flying over the neighborhood that day in July, I got so into deep diving and learning as much as I could about this sport. And I stumbled upon this guy on YouTube, Tucker Gott, who is probably, and JP, you can correct me, he's probably one of the biggest advocates and most well-known PPG pilots. But he's just like so relaxed in his videos. He's one of the most chill guys in general, it seems. That comes with a lot of experience, I'm sure. But what absolutely blew my mind was how much control you guys have over the wing with such precision that he's going like inches above the ground, slaloming in between hay bales in a field. And then he goes to McDonald's and grabs a burger, and then he flies back to the park and he's eating the burger on the way. And I'm just like, maybe I'm just drastically overestimating the amount of danger involved, but he's just so chill. And how well you can carve through such little tight spaces, and he's going under bridges and hopping from island to island in the Keys. And so I took a deep dive and was like consuming as much, you know, paramotor stuff as I could and became obsessed with it. And then once somebody in the neighborhood said, okay, this guy in our town, he works at the auto parts store, I was like, I got to get him on the podcast. So again, I know I said this at the top, but this is just really fun talking to you about something that's just so fascinating. But tell me a little bit about Tucker. Are there other guys that you follow, other big advocates of the sport? Like, I'd love to learn more about that.
Oh, yeah. I've got nothing but love for Tucker. Tucker is awesome. He represents the sport, you know, perfectly. He's a great guy. I actually won a raffle that he had going on his show when I was first in training. It worked out amazingly. I got an email when I was heading out to one of my first flights that I had won this awesome carbon fiber helmet that he was giving out. And that just set the tone for my whole, you know, sort of pathway into flying. And that, but yeah, he's great. And what I was saying earlier, that's kind of as is a thing that the Tucker Gott effect is, he makes it look so easy that people take that for granted. And they, you know, get into the sport thinking that they're going to do the things that he's doing, you know, off the bat. But it's, you don't see it in the videos, but he has hundreds and hundreds, probably, if I had to guess, he probably has, you know, at least multiple thousands of hours, probably 2,000 to 3,000 hours just flying, you know. Mm-hmm. You don't see all the time that he's put in. Most yeah. people are never going to fly like that. Not to say that it's, you know, not an achievable sort of thing, but he has tons and tons of time, and it's kind of barrel rolled for him. It worked out really well because now it's his job to fly. So he's yeah. going to fly more and more and more than the average person. And it just, you know, snowballs like that. He's going to get better and better. And, yeah. But yeah, I got nothing but love for Tucker. He's great.
To the danger aspect of it, I think it was in the video where he hits a personal best in terms of altitude, his highest altitude he had ever achieved. And he was, I think his goal was 15,000 feet in that video, and he went up to like 18, and he was, like you said, he was dressed for winter. And he's like, well, I don't know if I'll have enough gas to get back down, but again, I'm basically in a parachute. So, and it just dawned on me, like, oh, he doesn't need fuel necessarily for the entire return trip. But the idea in my head, somebody who doesn't understand it at all, going, he's going to run out of gas up there, is sheer terror.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's definitely one of the, one of the top five questions I always get is, what do you do if the engine stops? And it always makes me laugh because we're literally under a parachute. And, you know, it's... I go up all the time and just shut the engine off, and just there, nothing beats. We've got ear cups on our helmets to block the sound from the engine because it's really loud. But we'll kill the engine, pop the ear cups off, and just kind of whoosh,
whoosh, whoosh. I noticed.
Yeah. And yeah, nothing beats that. And, you know, one of the things you learn in training is that you're never supposed to fly in a situation that you couldn't get out of if the engine quit. Because it's an unregulated sport, our engines are not held up to the standard that, you know, a regulated airplane engine is required to follow. That we don't have, you know, it's not inspected. I'm not super up with the lingo that CFIs use, like certified airplane mechanics, where everything has to be safety wired together and it has to be maintained, you know, X amount of times for every 100 hours and stuff like that. Our engines are not held to that standard because the reality is that if something happens to us, the most that's going to happen is we're going to hurt ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, with airplanes and stuff like that, if you crash an airplane, there's a healthy chance that you're going to hurt, you know, the public, you know, crash into a house, kill somebody else. But with us, it's on ourselves to keep ourselves safe.
Yeah.
So you have to go into it with that mindset that, you know, this is a lawnmower engine on my back, and if it fails, I need to always be in a position where I can glide to safety. I need to, you know, not be over water. I need to not be over, you know, trees or power lines or neighborhoods. you gotta keep yourself in, you know, a safe situation. And it all goes, the more you fly, the more you recognize what, you know, what type of situation you can get in and out of, and how, you know, if you needed to land in a street or, you know, a narrow space, you know, you could probably do so. You might tangle up your wing in something, but at the end of the day, you know, as long as you keep yourself safe, you get better with that, with the experience, is what I'm trying to say. So
I think between that answer and the Tucker Gott thing, that's a good segue to a question that I had. So most people would probably look at what you're doing and already view it as extreme. But you've been doing this for 3 years, so you've got a little bit of experience. What would somebody like Tucker Gott, or what would somebody like you view as extreme now? Now that you've done what you've done, what's extreme to you?
You brought up the wingsuit thing. I think there's, you know, potential for a lot to go wrong really quickly. I've seen some of the clips where the guys, what they like to do is see how close they can get to something without hitting it. And I just have anxiety just watching those, because it can all go wrong so quickly. And typically with what we do, as long as your gear is in good shape, it's difficult to have things go south that quick. Not that it can't happen. It definitely can, you know. If all the stars line up and all of your lines break at once, or if you lose a carabiner or something, but that's why I like to have the backup plan with the, you know, reserve parachute. And some guys will even fly with a secondary reserve parachute. A lot of people refer to it as a motorcycle in the sky. You know, it's driving a motorcycle on a road with nobody else around you, because, you know, the sky is so open that it's extremely unlikely to have any sort of collisions or anything like that. Not including fly-ins. Fly-ins are potentially dangerous for that reason, because you have so many people together flying it in kind of like a fishbowl. So everybody wants to fly around the landing zone. But when you're flying, you know, at your home away from everybody else, it's just, the potential for danger is not very high. But I would say wingsuiting. But then again, you know, it's all about how you approach it. You know, I think the wingsuiters, if they double and triple check their equipment, and they, you know, they look at the weather beforehand and they visualize and all that, it's everything is as safe or dangerous as you make it. You know, people ask me all the time, you know, how dangerous is flying? And it depends. What kind of flying are you doing? What kind of weather are you going up in? What kind of gear are you flying? It's all about, you know, your flying style. Everything plays a role into how dangerous it is. You know, driving a car can be dangerous. How do you drive? What kind of car do you drive? What kind of traffic are you driving in? You know, are you racing? It's everything is about how you approach, you know.
Yeah, there was I think relatively recently there was a famous wingsuiter who died. Who, like, because I remember seeing a thing where, like, I believe it was he and his wife used to wingsuit together, and there was a particular, like, rock formation that formed like a keyhole that he used to,
and they wanted to bug the keyhole, probably, right, go right through it.
And I guess it's, I think if I'm remembering correctly, it's something that he's done before at that location, and just this time it went awry. And it killed him. But I mean, certainly, like, a wingsuiter, like, to your point, could choose, I'm not going to do the keyhole thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
But in your sport, recently, I have seen videos on your channel of barrel rolling and, in your words, shenanigans. So then I have a couple questions there about that. When we're seeing things like barrel rolls or like the weaving around obstacles and things, how risky is that really? And second question is, if there is risk, like potential death involved, which I don't, like I said, I don't know the answer to the first question, which means I don't know the answer to this one, but how do you practice that kind of thing? A skateboarder falls on a ramp and, like, gets rash, right? But they're fine. I'm wondering, how do you practice a barrel roll?
Well, it doesn't happen overnight. I would say it happens very progressively. If you go back and look at, I guess, some of my earlier YouTube videos, you just see, you know, this, and, you know, and in my head, it's like, oh, that's cool. You know, look, check this, I'm getting really risky, you know, and it just develops, it I don't know how to describe it other than you develop a feel for it over time. And when you're getting sideways with your wing, you can feel when your lines are tensioned, you're safe.
Yeah.
If your lines are sloppy, you're not safe, because that's when you run the potential for collapse. Or if you're above the wing, you run, you know, the position of falling into the wing. But when your lines are taut, you're good. You're good. If you're doing rolls like that, you can not do them perfect. That's how you would know, you know, if what we have tip collapses, which are, you know, little indications that you're not doing something right.
Is that like the big ears terminology?
No, well, yeah, that's big ears is an intentional move to.
Oh, sorry. You know,
yeah, that's like to lose altitude. You're cutting the surface area of the wing down so you can get down faster. But essentially, okay. That's what would happen if you're trying to do a rollover. You could fold partially, you know, any part of the wing over. Now, most of the time, that's going to pop back out, but that would indicate that you're doing something wrong. But if you can do a good roll without having any floppiness in the wing or any, you know, folding over, then, you know, you're probably doing something right. So you can, there's, you know, different levels of that. It's not like you either fall out of the sky or do it perfect. You know, there's different variations of the move. So
I was just imagining those were the only two possible outcomes, and I started laughing.
Yeah. With that being said, mine are always perfect. So
there you go.
So I think I do have a video somewhere of maybe like a 40% collapse. I wonder if I could key that up.
So is it, I mean, collapse, all of my questions are coming out of pure ignorance.
No, it all starts somewhere.
It's how I choose to do interviews. So if a wing collapses on you, obviously you're still alive.
Until you hit the ground, yeah.
Until you no, like you currently right now. Oh, you've experienced wings collapsing and you're still alive. I'm wondering, like, I'm not expecting you to have statistics, but like how big of a risk do you feel like you're taking when
that's why I said what I said about the safety in the last 10 years has really gone up. You know, a small collapse before might have been unrecoverable, whereas the wing technology has really, you know, increased in the last few years, where it's more likely to, you know, the few cells that are pressurized will repressurize the rest of the wing and pop it back out. I have no idea what the statistics are, but I would say the majority of the time it does, you know, pop out, and you're going to be okay, unless, you know, you get incredibly sloppy with your lines.
So as long as you have like your basic fundamentals down, which I mean, most people are going to at that point, it seems like a self-correcting problem at that point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, JP, while you're looking up that video, you've mentioned that it's like the restrictions are surprisingly little.
Yes.
And I mean, I've seen guys, not you, definitely not you, like flying right over power lines. And
oh yeah, I would never do anything like that. Incredibly dangerous.
and getting pretty low to the ground in town there. Have you made friends with local law enforcement? How many people call the cops on you? And is it usually noise complaints, or is it usually people just wondering what the heck is going on?
That's funny you bring that up. It used to be when I flew in Sunbury, I would have probably 60% of the time I would have a police officer there waiting for me when I would land. And not because I had done anything wrong. It would be whether, you know, someone called it in and saw me, you know, descend real quick, and they weren't sure, you know, if I was okay or not, or they would have someone report it, and the officer would be there with his hands in his pockets and, Yeah, I'm here to investigate. You know, I'm not really sure what law you've broken, but, you know, I got to show up. And then, you know, I'll explain to them FAR 103, which is the regulation that, you know, says that we're okay to do the things that we do. And they'll be like, oh, cool. And then they'll say, how much, you know, what do I got to do to get involved with this sport? Yeah. You know? And that's always where the line of questioning.
Yeah.
You have a video, I think, of cops like in the background. Just
absolutely.
Like,
yes, I do.
What they're seeing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 90% of the time it's, they're just curious and they want to see what's going on. And, as long as you tend to, you know, be courteous, you know, people don't own the airspace above their property, which they don't realize, but it's a big gray area. So as long as, you know, give them a couple hundred feet. Don't buzz their roof. Don't drag your feet across, you know, the shingles. If you do that, if you give them, I've had people call in before and say that I was circling their house, watching them, you know, like through their window, watch TV or do yoga or something like that. It's just so ridiculous. But that is not, you know, the norm. Most people are pretty cool about it. And,
I think the only other regulation is about like 30 minutes before or after sunset, you have to have a light or something like that.
Yeah. 30 minutes before sunrise and 30 minutes after sunset, you have to have a blinky strobe that can be seen for like 2 or 3 nautical miles or,
yeah,
you know, it's.
And that's about it. Otherwise, you're good. Do what you want to do.
There's not much more to it. The other ones say to stay away from, you're not to fly directly over populated areas, which it's very difficult to gauge. How, you know, are you directly over?
Right.
Or are you off to the side? You know, what is a populated area? You know, it's, and how high up do you have to be, so it, everything is open to interpretation. It's a very, very gray rule that is FAR 103. If you look up FAR 103, which is the rule that ultralights fall under, it's like a page or two. And in this, you know, giant FAA book of rules, there's very little rules for us. And the biggest rule, which is known throughout the community, they say DBAD, which is don't be a can you say a dick on here? Don't be a dick, you know. Be courteous to people, you know, just be mindful of the noise that we make. And most times if you're, you know, flying over somebody's property or something the first, second time, they're going to think it's pretty cool. But if you're doing it consistently over and over again, they're probably going to get annoyed about it. So, you know, that's in Sunbury, I try to not loiter too much in the same place. You know, but Sunbury's great, man. The majority of people are waving. They got the phones out, you know.
Oh, yeah. That was me, dude. That very first time you were out, I was like, hey,
yeah.
Hey, like a little kid trying to get the semi to honk for him.
I love it. I love it. I love seeing the enthusiasm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think you were going to say the one rule was don't chuck your monster cans when you're done with them.
That's true.
Make sure to land with those.
Oddly enough. You would think it would be a rule to not throw stuff out of the air, but that is not a rule.
Oh my gosh. You could have some serious fun with water balloons.
Oh yeah.
Those little plastic army guys with the parachutes. You could
I have some of those and
not
I
over neighborhoods.
I'm not over neighborhoods. Exactly.
Not over neighborhoods, but you could, in theory, maybe they'd float that way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Towards the kids.
Yeah. Towards the kids.
You should fly on Halloween and Christmas Eve and have little baskets of goodies and things for kids that are from a parachute.
There's a guy that did that last year. He became like extremely famous because he crashed on his way out. He dressed up as Santa
and he was flying
a wheeled unit. You can see him right here. He's wearing a Santa outfit.
And if you're not listening on YouTube, this is a really good excuse to come find this episode on YouTube so you can see this picture.
Well, he's in power lines, man.
Like he is tangled up very badly. The fire department had to come. They had to shut it all off. That whole corner of the town lost power. That was not a good day, but he, you know, his heart was in the right place. He was, I think he was on his way to a church.
Like when they found him, it was,
it was still located in the,
yeah, still there.
That too.
That's good.
But no, I think he was on his way to pass out candy canes or something, you know, and it just, you know, stuff happens.
Okay. Don't do that. That's not what I meant. Oh man. This has been great, man. We've really, really enjoyed having you on. I can't believe it's already been like an hour. Special shout out to Sean Buzensky, who made the connection and told me who you were. I know he's like a super fan of yours, and he likes to hang out with like the other Central Ohio paramotor guys. So thanks, Sean, for making the connection. Where can people follow you and check out your videos and stuff on social media? Where's the best place for all?
I'm on a show every Monday night called Clear Prop TV. And the guy who runs that show, PPG Grandpa, he got me my own domain, actually. So if you go to www.jptulo.com, J-P-T-U-L-O.com, it'll take you to one of my social medias. And then if you get to one of them, you can get to most of them. I'm on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. I think that's all of them. And all of them is some variation of J-P-T-U-L-O. One of them has like a... what's the underscore in between?
Yep.
After the JP.
We'll be sure to share all those on our socials as well. But Kendall, Dylan, anything else from you guys?
No, man.
That was it. Super interesting. Thanks for joining us, man. This was great.
Oh, this was fun. Absolutely.
Cool. Well, we'll see you in the clouds. Be sure to go to artiusman.com. That's artiusman.com for all your men's grooming products. Use promo code THEMIDDLE at checkout to get 25% off your order. And if you want some CBD mints, there's three awesome flavors of CBD mints from an awesome company called Stello Mints. That's STELLOMINTS.com. Use promo code THEMIDDLE at checkout to get 10% off all orders. And maybe you could take some CBD while you're up in the air and just really enjoy.
Get high while you're high.
Hey. Awesome. Thanks for joining us tonight, man. It's been a blast, and we'll see you up there.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Bye.